Well, hey, friends, it's Lacey and Drew, and today we're here with special guests, Tim and Sophia, and we can't wait to tell their story, hear their story, and share their story. They're doing a lot of really amazing things, and I think they're kind of newer to the homestead world, so I'm excited to hear they're, like, fresh for me. You know, Drew and I, we've been doing it for a long time, so I think we're going to be revitalized by this conversation a lot.
Welcome to the Schoolhouse Life and our I Bought a Homestead, Now What podcast.
I'm Lacey.
And I'm Drew.
Homestead health and business strategist. And between us, we have nearly 40 years experience in homesteading, parenting, and holistic living. We love helping people live more sufficient, deeply rooted, and satisfyingly connected lives.
2 to 3 times per month, we post a new podcast on Wednesdays that will inspire, ease, and answer questions about this lifestyle you may not even know to ask.
People and homestead strategy clients ask us all the time how, why, and what to do to make their homestead less chaotic, more efficient, and mostly more peaceful. The lessons we've learned, the training we've had, and our strategic approach will help you skip steps and find more ease in your homesteading journey.
Did you hear something you like? Did you learn something new? Please share with a friend or on social. Tag us at The Schoolhouse Life, and we will be thrilled to share and connect. Your shares, encouragement, and even questions are what keep us going. Thank you.
Without further ado, Tim and Sophia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us, Lacey and Drew. Excited to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so you guys are up to some amazing things. So first and foremost, Sophia, I was told by Chelsea Green you wrote a book. We love Chelsea Green books for the most part, and have interviewed several authors from Chelsea Green Publishing and have so many of their books, I can't even count them. And they said you wrote a book and that you might be somebody worth talking to. And so I'm really excited for you to introduce us to that before we kind of move into the rest of our chat together. Would you share a few words about what inspired you and really what people can expect from that cookbook?
Yeah. So the book that I wrote with Chelsea Green was the Nourishing Asian Kitchen Cookbook. And like you, half of our books in our library are Chelsea Green books. So I'm honored to be a Chelsea Green author. And really, the Nourishing Asian Kitchen Cookbook was something that I wanted to write over 10 years ago when my first child was born. And it's essentially the sister companion for the Nourishing Traditions book written by Sally Fallon Morrell, who did write the foreword for my cookbook. So it's quite an honor.
Yeah, that's amazing. Very cool. Okay, how long did it take you to write this book? I'm like, writing a cookbook sounds really impressive.
Well, I had started writing it 12 years ago with my mom. When my daughter was born, I started looking into food and nutrition and what I was going to put into her little body. And that's kind of what started us down this path of more going back to the land and how I discovered Nourishing Traditions 12 years ago. But with our Asian palate, we were used to eating more umami flavors. So as I was cooking through Nourishing Traditions for my family, my parents in particular, who are immigrants from Vietnam, they're more used to the umami flavors, which is that savory, you know, the fish sauce, traditionally fermented, soy sauce. And I realized that there's a missing gap. So I had started writing and recreating our recipes to be more Weston A. Price focused and inspired, waiting for this book, for someone else to write the book. I really did not feel like I was the one to do this, but I had, you know, I worked full time. I worked in marketing and tech. So my hours were always crazy at work, but I wanted to always spend intentional time feeding those that I loved and continue to do so. But that's kind of what started that. And so throughout the years, I've been writing the recipes from my mom, working alongside her in the kitchen. I've collected all of the dishware. I thrifted all of these over the last 10 years. And those are the same photos and dishes that made it into the photo in the cookbook. But importantly, I only had 3 months to write this book.
Wow.
All the photos, but we got it done because I had most of the work cut out for me. It was just a matter of putting it all together.
Yeah. Wow. That's lovely. I love that it's your tradition, but with this like really wholesome, I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with the Nourishing Traditions cookbook, and it on its own is like it can be very overwhelming, right? But to take the recipes you're familiar with and kind of just tweak them in a way, it feels more doable. We probably all could do that on some level instead of just saying, oh, I'm just going to cook what's in here. Really think about the foods you're eating and shift it into a more wholesome, nourishing tradition kind of way. I love that.
Could you give us an example of like one that you tweaked? Like when I think of a lot of Asian recipes, I feel like it is kind of like a low broil, like a broil or like, you know, like more hearty and healthy than the American diet. Yeah, and ferments and things. So what was it that you were tweaking?
A lot of it is not using any of the seed oils, number one. A lot of it is also not using any of the preservatives and additives that are found in our Asian condiments. So that's kind of the journey that I had to take, because once I started looking into additives, preservatives, herbicides, pesticides, I went one by one through all of our condiments and sauces that we had in the pantry, in the refrigerator, started throwing them out one by one and replacing them. So in the cookbook, I start off with mastering the basics, and it really is our Asian sauces and condiments.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
So if you go back farther in time, I'm assuming that those were like the ingredients in those were more wholesome than what we have now. But yeah, that's amazing, because yeah, that's a lot of what stops me from cooking that style is all the preservatives and things in there.
Absolutely. And even though I grew up eating homemade cooked Asian food, it was still using a lot of those sauces and condiments. And so that was the primary focus for me throughout the years, and why I wanted to open up the book with that intro section, is to make sure that you nail that down, because then once you master the basics, you can create any other recipe and concoction. And as we look at the conversations that are happening today in America, you know, we're starting to see kimchi available now in most modern grocery stores. I'm not even talking about the natural grocery stores where we started to see it a couple of years ago. But now recently you can go to a major grocery store and see kimchi. You can find chicken feet, chicken heart, and chicken liver. And so the conversations are naturally happening where people are starting to be familiarized with it, but not exactly sure how to make it, how to cook with it, how to prepare it. And that's where I feel the timing is right for. I mean, it did take me 12 years to come together to write the book, but I feel like the timing is right where the conversations can happen now.
And to your point, Drew, how they cook traditionally, and Sophie talks about it, is like, for an example, they use bone broth, and now they're mimicking that with MSG, with the bouillon cubes, just to make things quicker, faster, more convenient.
And more profitable.
Yes.
Right.
How are the conversations within the Asian community regarding this there? Have you started to have this? Because I feel like that's probably like a hard sell, is like, don't do MSG or, you know,
It's a hard sell. Although I feel that, you know, growing up this way, it was easy, right? We'd go to the Asian grocery store. My mom would buy pastured pork, but also pasture raised chickens. And I grew up butchering them and actually harvesting the organs, chopping off the feet. And like, I grew up like that, even in the Bay Area. But when I had my daughter 12 years ago and started looking into cooking just applesauce, and in a Williams-Sonoma cookbook, it had told me, if you're going to make your own applesauce or pear sauce, make sure that you try to source organic, because the baby's body is not yet developed to process the toxic and harmful chemicals from herbicides and pesticides.
When do we develop that? What age?
Exactly. So that was my follow-up question. Naturally, it was like, fine, because you have to understand, in our culture, you could not step into a Whole Foods and say that you bought organic fruit. I mean, I even tried to tell my mom that, and she would, it's this, you know, your Whole Foods was only accessible to a certain demographic and your income level, right? And so if I were to go there, it would be as if I wasn't being responsible with our money, and you're spending frivolously, right? And so now it's more accepted, I feel like, with my cousins that are, you know, all the same age, a little bit younger, and now they're starting to talk about organic. But when I first started talking about it at home, I remember it was a Thanksgiving dinner. My aunt came by and she was pouring lemonade for everybody. And she poured lemonade in my cup and she said, "Sophia, this is organic lemonade from my organic lemons in my back." And, you know, I just smiled. I just kind of, you know, shook it off. But that was the kind of pressure that we got in our culture. Mm-hmm. So the conversation around MSG is also very challenging. It's also very difficult. There's this whole campaign now that's pro MSG, But if you look at MSG, it is an excitotoxin. It's chemically processed in a lab. And however you feel about it, I think for me and my family, I've grown up and we choose to just, you know, especially being as homesteaders too, we choose to create our food from scratch. And if it's something that we can't create, then we're going to source and make sure it's traditionally fermented, but definitely not made in a lab.
I think we're on the same page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are you making like your own soy sauce? Like, is that in the book, the recipe for that?
I have a recipe for traditionally fermented fish sauce, since we go so much of it. Traditionally fermented soy sauce is something that is a little bit trickier to make. And so I source clean. There's only two sources that I recommend, two brands that I recommend. And one of them is directly imported from Japan, and they still follow the traditionally fermented. Because even in Japan these days, they're starting to step away from it because of profit and convenience. Yeah. And so there's one brand that I trust, and I have that in my Amazon cart somewhere where, and actually we, Tim and I were in Hawaii. We were in Honolulu. We actually interviewed the store owner of the rice factory who gave us a lot of the history of the traditionally fermented soy sauce. And we love it. It is, I mean, a little bit goes a long way. And there is another soy sauce that I grew up with called Mazi, or Maggie, M-A-G-G-I-E. And it was also, it's obviously processed, but I grew up with that thinking that my mom would say, oh, this is made in France. And so it was cleaner, right? In France, right? And so, but this soy sauce actually tastes very much like it. And you need just a little bit to, and it goes a long way.
Wow. It sounds like you guys might be as food nerdy as we are.
I know. Yeah.
Better match.
All right. So since you said rice, are you guys growing rice on the homestead?
No, not yet. And only because
we don't have
that water. But there is another Asian farmer out in North Carolina, and they're an Asian farming family, and they grow organic rice. And so we do purchase from them because it's clean. They're also small farmers and they're right over the hill. So we love to support that whenever we can.
Well, listen, we've grown rice, and as fun as it is, it's still in our pantry because we don't have a hauler. And that would be a very expensive piece of equipment to have for just a few cups of rice. So.
Yeah. And we go through a lot of rice.
I've been forbidden to grow anymore. We have probably like,
takes up a lot of
room. A bunch of jars of it. When the end of the world comes, we're set. We'll be scraping off the hulls of the rice. But until then.
Yeah. Well, let's move on. So I think I like your story. And I think that it's a really familiar one that we hear a lot about, you know, sort of hitting this March 2020. And like your mind just kind of went crazy with like, oh, gosh, we're changing. We're shifting gears. And I would love for you to share a little bit. So did you both grow up in California area, or what is your history there?
Yeah, we were both born on the same day, same year, yeah. And same city.
Yeah, same.
But different hospitals.
Yeah.
Oh, different moms. You're not twins. Yeah.
Yeah. We are 3 hours apart because I like to kid and say that I don't date younger men. They barely made it.
I was immature. It was all God.
Oh, that's adorable.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So we grew up in high school. We ran track together, but we were actually high school rivals. We were not, we were not high school sweethearts.
They didn't like me at all.
That's amazing. Wow. Okay. So I know that you've had some really like, you know, high end jobs, so to speak, in the like tech world and whatnot. Can you share a little bit about how did you end up taking that path?
Yeah, so I was pre-med, and I think it was due to the fact that mom had bought these chickens home and she would make me harvest, and I just loved it. I mean, the chickens that I harvested, there were some that had whole eggs in them, and I thought that was so fascinating to see as a young child. So I loved surgery. I love, you know, in my mind, I'm like, I'm gonna be a surgeon. And so I went to pre-med. I was in a 7-year BA MD program at George Washington University. The problem was that I only had one nutrition course, and I grew up with obviously my parents who were very traditional. And while my parents came here in the fall of Saigon in 1975, we really didn't have anything growing up. So my mom would often work two jobs, two full-time jobs, and my grandfather would raise me. And so I spent a lot of time with him in the backyard garden. They lived about a block away from us. And he always taught me that food was medicine. He used to say that eat to live, do not live to eat. And he was always like a very stern man. And I didn't get it then until, you know, obviously having kids and going through this journey that I realized, wow, food truly is medicine. But I was expecting that in college. I was expecting to have a more holistic mindset because that's kind of how I grew up. But that was not the case. And that was a big shocker for me. And then I went on to get my master's in clinical psychology. And then we got married. And then after we got married, my mom was starting to have some health problems. And so I would fly back to California. We were, the last studio station was in Kirtland Air Force Base, where he was stationed. Tim's a West Point grad and served. Oh, nice. and so when I moved back to the Bay Area, I was trying to figure out, you know, what could I do with my science and psychology background? And I'm very resourceful. So that lended really well for a career in marketing and tech. And so I worked very well with startups and working with startups, specifically lean startups, where there's not a lot of resources, not a lot of funds, but you need to grow a company quickly because there's investment, right? And so that's where I would come in because I'm very resourceful. I can make a lot of things happen with nothing. but yeah, we saved up enough money. We bought a quarter acre in the Bay Area, which was very expensive. It was a small 3-bedroom, 1-bath, but it like took up all of our savings. And I was just happy with a quarter acre. And when we bought that home, I made sure that there was a food delivery app called Instacart. And at that time, Whole Foods was still delivering through Instacart until they got acquired by Jeff Bezos from Amazon in 2017. And that was the moment where I'd say we started growing our own food, because I'm okay with tech outside of our food, but when tech starts entering our food is when I start questioning everything. And I started questioning if organic was truly even organic anymore, but that's what did it for me. That was my aha moment to realize.
So you're a cynic, a little bit of a cynic.
Completely, yeah. And it's just gotten me down this path of like, just tell me the truth. And if you can't tell me the truth, then I'll get to it myself. And a lot of it I realize is food marketing, and my background in psychology, I can call out, I can see, and now we teach the kids. I mean, I don't know if this is part of homeschooling, but this is how I teach them. We look at billboards, I look at websites, and I tell them, what are they trying to sell you? What are they, who are they talking to? And we really break it down. And yeah, I even teach them poker so that they can, you know, start taking a look at patterns and taking a look at, you know, if people are telling you the truth or not.
We were different because I wasn't on that same train on the same
path. I was going to say.
She mentioned. Yeah.
Are you riding along or what?
No, I was dragging my heels a little bit. As Sophie mentioned, I went to West Point, served in the military. I was very good about complying and following a system. I would say we've had some arguments in the past. Even when we started our own business, we had a froyo shop, and I was fighting, for instance, to go franchise route because I always want a systematic approach. And she is always the one asking questions and bucking the system. So she'll say, no, we don't have to pay franchise fee. We're just going to learn from the best and we'll create our own. And I remember we had an argument over a bed and breakfast. Yeah. And we went your route, and I was afraid, but it actually turned out to be really, 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 really good in Albuquerque. But fast forward, coming 2020, you know, up to that point, yes, I was complying with everything. And then she really was starting to question a lot of things that was coming up. And of course, I would, you know, ask the questions like, why would they do that? Why can't you just go along here? And so it really opened my eyes, because she comes from the marketing background and psychology. So she came from pre-med and switched over to psychology. And that was actually funny, because on our first date, you gave me a
MMPI 2.
Yeah, it's like a 567
question for personality and
what kind of personality disorders I had. And so she's I did.
Was it like close, or was it like,
I don't know, she never gave me the results, but clearly she was okay with it, because, or safe enough. But that led to a career in psychology, and then moved over to marketing and just lent itself well to marketing. And so when she opened my eyes to how we're being targeted in marketing campaigns, I started noticing these things, you know, when I'm pumping my gas on the billboards, and I'm like, everywhere. Because you're trying to sell me so hard, I'm gonna question things. And we had a quarter acre, as Sophie mentioned, but it was like California. You want to have the pretty, you know, raised garden beds. You want, you know, okay, so they're shutting things down, so we need to get some chickens, but we're going to get heritage birds that have pretty eggs that are, you know, Instagram worthy. And fast forward to look at where we've come from there. Now we grow in mounds. We want to just make sure that things make sense.
Orpingtons.
Yeah. Dual purpose. So things that make more sense when you homestead, because it was a leap of faith. Up until that point, 2020 I was in real estate, and I was focusing on helping fellow veterans in the Bay Area. In the Bay Area, we're in a housing bubble, but I was standing up for them, and Sophie was also helping me out on the loan side. She was doing lending since 06, and I got into it, and we had our best years, 2020 and 2021. So to kind of walk away from that and say, okay, we're going to start farming, that was really tough. Yeah. For me, at least.
Yeah, that's beautiful, though. I mean, to know the truth and then seek it more, I think, is it's a hard thing. But when you don't do that, it can be devastating, I think. So I think you took the right path. Well done. Yeah, I just love that story. I think one of the things that I kept thinking of, Drew read this book a couple of years ago, because we do a lot of marketing for our businesses and things and have for years. And Drew's kind of into it and did a lot of research. He read a book of several years ago called Trust Me, I'm Lying to You. And it was about marketing. And I really think that book is pivotal in my sort of understanding of everything that happened in the last, you know, 4 years, and that, you know, even before that, now I shed light on. But I think it's one of those books that like everyone should read, you know, whether you're into marketing or not, you need to understand marketing because you're a consumer, right? One way or another, you're a consumer. Yeah. And the way they talk about how information is dropped strategically, false information, true information, all of it intermingled to confuse you. And a lot of it just completely fabricated, like for the sake of selling something in the end. And that continues to happen, you know, over and over and over again. A couple of weeks ago, there was a thing that went around the internet, and it's made it come up again, but it was where it was like some article that said that by home gardens release more carbon than big industry or something like
that. Yeah.
Which is just like you know, it's such a joke, but it's at the same time, then I saw another article about it and another article. That was what this whole book was about, how he would just make some random thing up and send it to blogs who are looking for content, and then it would get posted, and then it would just turn into this like snowball effect. And I see people, you know, sharing it and being like, this is ridiculous. I'm like, it's working. Oh my gosh, they're going to convince everybody that this is true just by putting it out there. And so, yeah, it does. It's like this total shift of like, oh, whatever. It makes me, though, I do worry a little bit of like not trusting anyone or anything ever. So fine line, right? I'm like, okay, but how do I live my life also?
Staying on the homestead.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, we're just natural skeptics, I think, at this point now. And I start off with kind of, you know, again, it's all about reading and reading people, reading people's actions and taking a good look at it. And that's why I think it's so important for me to teach the kids, even though we've gotten some pushback, like, are you teaching your kids how to gamble? And it's like, no, it's all the psychology behind how people play, how people bet, how people, you know, how they call and how they fold. Like, and one of the most important things, and I don't know, it's probably in my blood because my dad taught me how to play poker, and I really like it, not for the money aspect of it, but just so that I could practice reading people. But one of the things he always told me was like, the most important thing about playing poker is knowing when to fold. And because these are the things, like even in relationships, even in, you know, putting how much money that we put into our land in California, you know, knowing when to say no and knowing when, like, just because I've gone down this path or I've invested this much money or I've invested this much time with someone or something, you need to know when it's okay to say no. And that's the hardest part of it, I think. And that's something I'd rather teach the kids in a matter of like playing at the dinner table together than like preventing them to have to learn these harder lessons outside, which I'm sure they will. But
it makes me think of how emotionally attached we become to the things in our lives, whether it's an activity that we do or the life trajectory we were on, and how we will give in so much more because we're emotionally attached. And if we can kind of disassociate and say, look, I'm going to take my emotions out of the equation and make a decision that is the right decision for right now, I think that's a really important skill. So I love it. My kids like poker. We don't play it a lot, but we now maybe we will.
I'm really resisting the song.
I know.
The gambler.
Yeah. Know when to what? Yep.
Know when to fold. Yeah.
That's hilarious. I think we sing that a lot around our house.
We do. Yeah. So you guys moved to Tennessee and you're farming and that's your income now? Or do you have like an off the homestead income, or what do you do now?
Yeah, that's one of the things that, at least for now, we have made a very conscious decision to not have our homestead be our primary income, only because we really have enjoyed this, the low pressure of like, if we started a CSA and we were still failing with all the pests that are here in East Tennessee, then like, I don't want to disappoint our customers. And also number one, number two is that we have such an overabundance now, and I want to be able to gift that and bless people with it without having to feel, because I know I'm going to feel a certain way. If I already know I'm charging my milk for this much or my tomatoes for this much and my lettuce for this much, if I know I can get this, then I just know personally, I'm not going to give as much to others. And so we've made a conscious decision to say, that's not going to be, at least while we can still work, let's have our outside income. So we do, most of our income has been through real estate and marketing consulting on my side.
Nice.
Okay. I think that's wise. We've made similar decisions about what are the goals of our homestead. And it really is we homeschool, like we've talked about, and the goal is to teach our children to learn side by side and to experience nature and that process. And if you, props to people who make it a business, but it's been just a side part of what, how we bring in the actual financial, but we love homesteaders and we love this, this kind of camaraderie that we all naturally feel when we are attuned to that, like when you're raising and killing chickens, there's just a different understanding that we all have, a different foundation that we all come to the table with. So, I really appreciate that. Okay, yes. So you do the homestead real estate. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm known as a homesteading realtor. I help a lot of the families and people who are just seeking refuge from the cities and the suburbs and wanting to look into homesteading. So we didn't have that when we were looking. We've looked at several states, and we talk about in our podcast, we stopped in Texas, Oklahoma, which secretly, I wanted those states to work because that would have been an easier transition for me. But we went out to East Tennessee. And
pretty hardcore out here.
East Tennessee, we are in the middle of the woods here. But what sold it for me was the community. And we talk a lot about community. And that's something that we did not have before. And realizing that you can't homestead alone. You can't own every single piece of equipment. There's a set budget that you have. You have to make do with what you've got. And we found our people out here because we just feel at home.
Yeah, we barter. We rarely have to go to the grocery store anymore. And this is one of the reasons why we left California, was because there wasn't a lot of like-minded people who wanted to do life the way that we do. Mm-hmm. And this is us coming from the consumer side. Like, we were consumers. We worked to make our money and we went to the grocery store. We started growing our food in 2017 and then really 2019. I don't know when you'd say we officially became homesteaders, but I don't even know what that means, but
graduated.
I wanted more food security, especially after 2020.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that we didn't have enough people who believe the things that we did. Mm-hmm. And so we sought out to find community. And though we ended up selling the quarter acre to move up to 5 acres to bring in ruminants, because we were like, we need more of a protein source. So that's what we did. For about a good year, we went to Joel Salatin's, and we had an RV, so we drove all the way around to find other communities and other farmers who were doing it. But ultimately, we finally looked up and had a moment to breathe. We were like, we can't do this by ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then because I do lending, I knew January 2022, there were already rumors. And this was after refinancing us mm-hmm. and many of our clients in California down to 2.25% interest rate.
Yeah.
Like, we were for sure beating inflation then.
Yep.
I was like, hey, you know, honey, I think that the rates are going to go up. And of course, like, if you know what you know, everything's manipulated, all the systems, financial system, especially real estate. And so I didn't know how much it was going to go up, and I didn't know how quickly they were going to do it. And so I said, well, if we're going to think about ever leaving, we've got to go now. But you also have to understand, all of our business, all of the people that we ever knew, grew up knowing, were all in California. So we're talking about moving, you know, not just an entire farm, but moving away from all the life that we've known in California.
It was a total mindset shift. And when we made the move, we couldn't find any realtors who understood what we were looking for, that we didn't want to be near 5G towers or electrical towers. I mean, for instance, and that we want, natural source of water. And because of this, and because of the journey, then that's why I fell into this niche, you know, sharing our story and helping others avoid the mistakes that we made. Because if you're like us, you're going to want to have grown your food years ago. And if you have that kind of fire and that kind of motivation, I want to help you get there faster, hit the ground running. And that's where I feel like we've married up, and we're like, providing this hybrid blend of Silicon Valley speed to homestead grittiness, you know, where, okay, you want to hit the ground running, we'll show you how to do it, in combination with forming relationships, because it does take time. And that's where the time takes place, is building trust within the community. And my clients, they range, you know, you can go as extreme as wanting to become a prepper. But if you're a prepper, you know, you also have to find some sort of balance where you're going to be part of the community. You have to build some sort of trust, and you can't just find a bug out spot, because you need to actually establish yourself in the community and show yourselves like what skill sets you have. And that for us was like a wake up call, because coming from the Bay Area, when you meet people, it's almost like, well, this is what I do, and this and what you do defines who you are, and check out my LinkedIn profile. But when you come out to the country, it was like, well, what skill sets do you have? They don't ask you what you do for a living, but what do you know how to do? And that was a huge wake-up call. So for people who think that they can just like buy their way out into it, you can't. It takes time. And I want to be able to help all my clients ramp up as quickly as possible.
Love that. Yeah, there's so many people who are like, I just need someplace that's safe, you know, and they find something that's like deep mm-hmm. in the woods that, you know, we learned the hard way. You can't actually grow a lot in the woods. You have to cut those trees down, and that's a lot of work. So, there's definitely lessons that you can share and bring for people to make it easier.
I think there's a large element of trust too. Like you said, like, it's one thing when it's like, check out my LinkedIn profile, but it's another thing when your neighbor pulls up and gets out of his truck and leans against the hood of the truck. And, you know, if you don't come out and talk and spend an hour chatting about what's going on, like, you just lost all credit. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's going to be years to gain that back.
I'm going to just, and to caveat off of that, if we can do it coming out here into the South, and we are California, like being called California Chinese investors, like, come on, like, that is far from the truth of where we're at. But we are not only surviving, like, we're thriving within the community and building trust within the community. Like, there's something to be said there. And we can do it. You can do it too. You know?
That's true. I mean, I've also been known, like, the first year when we first moved out here, Tim wasn't here. And I obviously didn't post that out. So I mean, the first year, what did you call me?
She was the admin part. So she was basically scouting it out, doing the recon. Yeah.
But I mean, I naturally just like want to find our people. So I've been known to like jump out of the truck because there was another truck coming and he had a license plate that I was like, oh my gosh, he's totally our people.
Yeah.
Like flagging people down. And
that's how.
And it's just like, yeah. But they're so great here. The people here, and now they are the same people who helped put up our fencing. We do competitive game nights together with our families, with grandmas and grandpas.
Well, our personalities complement each other. She's more extroverted. I'm more introverted. And so she kind of laid the foundation so that it was like a warm greeting when I came in. And it was good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, yeah, I can tell you guys are very like well matched and suited. I love it. It's a really good dynamic. It's bringing both your strengths to the table. And I think that's the hard part with homesteading is, you know, I think we all are like, we have this urge to be quote unquote self-sufficient, but what we don't realize is what we're really urgently needing and wanting and craving is that community with nature and with the people in that community also.
Yeah.
And it can be really isolating to choose homesteading and not also take all of that into account. And I've seen a lot of people kind of come and go because of that isolation. So it's really wisdom that you realize and take in that into account.
For us, for me, it's always been food. So how I bring community together, at least my people together, is I can bribe them with food. Right? So like we have our own dairy. We have a micro dairy. We have 4 dairy cows right now. And obviously enough, more than enough for our family, our animals, our farm, but any extras we'll make, I'm making a long fermented Vietnamese yogurt, which is very nourishing, but it's also very delicious. It's like a French Vietnamese recipe.
We need that recipe.
This is in the cookbook or?
Not in this cookbook. Cookbook number 2 that my I'm working with my daughter on. Of course.
There's that marketing right there. Marketing.
I see what you're doing.
Yeah.
don't leave us hanging.
But I mean I make our Asian food and I'm bringing it to our community here. And if anybody's sick or if they just had a baby, I'm cooking out of the cookbook. The pho is the chicken pho is the easiest thing. It's most accessible. And we barter with other people. We barter milk or our milk for our non-sprayed hay for our cows. And, you know, he's just as invested as we are to not spray his hay because I specifically ask him not to spray it. And I'll get all his grass.
I know this sounds all wonderful. And this is great that we got to where we're at right now. But we had to fight against 2 things prior to getting to where we're at. The first thing is that we came from the city. And so I remember when we moved to the countryside in California, I was like, I apologize to our neighbors up front. I said, look, if we seem unneighborly to you, it is because we're from the city. I'm used to staying in my house with a Ring doorbell and not knowing who my neighbors are. And
I have cameras. I have like a
spotlight. But in the country, you know, people will actually want to come over and borrow a cup of sugar, or their children will just show up at your house, I guess, for feeding their kids for the day. And so this was the whole lifestyle was new. And then the second thing is, I think our Asian culture, it really usually prohibits us from like asking for help. And that was another thing that we had to overcome through this entire process. But what Sophie is talking about was just painting this beautiful picture in mind. And that's what we have now, and it's great.
So I think a lot of people, like Asian culture aside, even a lot of homesteaders really struggle.
I think homesteaders are the worst example in American culture because they're like, forget this, I'm doing it by myself, right? And so that's not like, but nothing tears down a wall like asking for help. I mean, it really is like a way of making yourself vulnerable and then saying to the other person, what you are is valuable to me. And I mean, like that says so much in one little thing.
Can you describe how like some steps or maybe conscious thoughts you had on like, okay, we need to overcome this not asking for help kind of situation?
But we had to right away because financially, fiscally, it didn't make any sense for us to raise every single kind of animal. We started off with chicken. It's just no way possible. We need way more land and I need to clone myself or just more help. So that in itself was what really prompted us. And when we moved here to Tennessee, some of the elders here, they were trying to say that too. They're like, we know you're from California, but we want you to know you can ask for help. It's okay. You know, we're a community. I'm like, what are you talking about? Of course. Yeah. But we never did ask for a while. It took us a few months.
Yeah. I think I still struggle with it. I had our hay milk pickup today, and he said, you know, we just acquired another 22 acres to lease out to our local small farmers here.
Yeah.
And so they are starting a farm store, and we're putting things together, a garden area. And he was like, you know, do you need anything? And he kept saying, like, do you need anything? I'm like, good. And he's like, do you need anything? Like, I've got this, that, and the other. And I was like, oh, maybe. Yeah. Really hard. Mm. But I appreciate it. I don't know if it's because I'm a homesteader or because it's our culture in general, or I just don't like asking, but I don't really ask unless I absolutely need it. I mean, I told him, like, on our homestead, we're pretty much set. We're okay. I mean, with obviously we could use more hay, but other than that, we're okay.
I think that was in my text this morning.
Yeah. And I think for me, when I moved out here to Tennessee, I realized how vulnerable I was because I'm not very handy. And coming from the city, I never really went to Home Depot. We could just hire it out. I go on Yelp or Angie's. You come out here, there is no Yelp. What's that? And we'd have to go to the co-op or see whoever's posted on the, you know, the telephone pole or something like that. And for me, it was a wake up call where I had to be vulnerable and ask for help.
Yeah.
And so, okay, yeah, what did I do? We have an RV, just Sophie mentioned, when we went across the country. So what I did was, we have some friends that we made in Gatlinburg, and I took my RV and spent 3 weeks with them when they were building out their coffee shop.
Wow.
And he's super handy. He's an awesome artist, but he's also great at building things. And I wanted him to take me under his wing and, hey, I'm a blank slate and I'll just do whatever you need me to do, whatever grunt work. And I learned how to do drywalling and things. And it was really cool. And I learned so much and gave me the confidence to go out and go buy my set of tools and things like that, like things that I wished I was bothered in before. And so it's a huge learning curve, but
yeah,
really rewarding.
Oh, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. Okay. So my question is, we have several friends from California in our area that have did almost exactly the same as you. There was like an exodus, right? Mm-hmm. In 2021. And now all their family is coming too, which we love. I'm sure it's amazing. But I'm curious, do you think your family is going to follow you? And how do they feel about you having made this transition? Are they upset still or?
Well, I think so. Mom and Dad followed us. We did push back. We did get a lot of pushback from our friends, actually, who just thought, you know, we were crazy and that things were going to go back to normal. And I just didn't feel that, you know, we just didn't want to. But I think the saving grace is over what, 4 years now this has been going on. It's hard for me to think that there are people there who still believe that things are going back to normal with things that have taken place in the last 4 years. And I had talked about, guys, I think the price of food is going to be rising and we're going to be talking about hyperinflation. This was like 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they were telling us, no, no, no. And so I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to go and I'm going to prepare for it just in case, because I don't know, but just in case, I mean, we can at least print our own money by growing our own food and raising our own animals. We can hedge inflation that way. And so it's been a progress. And I think that people are starting to come around. We've had old clients who've reached out to us. And I think it's because of the book, where I do feel that it's not political at all, but I do call out a few three-letter agencies in there. And that's why I chose Chelsea Green, because I knew that they would be willing to publish it.
I respect them so much. They're willing to, you know, print both sides of the story. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I love them for that. But I also feel that we can have this conversation around food. Everybody can gather and we can have really tough conversations around food, because I believe that we can all agree that the food today is not as nutrient dense as it used to be, and you know, a lot more toxic than it was. And so we can have that conversation there, and that wherever you go from there, it doesn't matter to me, but at least we can come together for that. And
your family is getting there. My family, not so much, but I think ours is kind of what we're hearing from a lot of other people as well, where we've met a lot of couples out here that are older and their kids are not on board with it. But you know what? A lot of my clients, I'm seeing a trend. They're asking me for multi-generational properties, or at least enough land for them when their kids, maybe when they come around, that they'll have place to build. And yeah. So, yeah, that is the going trend.
And the thing about most of the people here who, in our area, who are homesteading, whether they're elders or even our age or a little bit younger, I think we're all kind of orphans. I think we're the black sheep of our families, I've noticed, where either the children have written them off or their family members have written them off. And so we become family to one another. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one of the most beautiful things for us to teach our children,
yeah,
is that blood doesn't necessarily mean that they're family. You can choose your own family. And some of my best friends here have been in the last couple of years because we've built together and we've gone through really hard things together as friends, and to be, you know, sisters to one another because our sisters weren't around.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. I love it. Okay. So this was a wonderful conversation. I think we could probably go on forever. So now we're just going to have to come visit you and you come visit us. But we need a whole weekend together. But what I wanted to know is just, I like to ask people, if I think of it on our calls, on our interviews, what are some of the things, just maybe one thing even, that you do to kind of keep yourself feeling your best, whether it's, you know, a wellness tip or just a habit that you have that you try to maintain.
Do you want to go?
You know what? Homestead burnout is real.
Yeah, so, for sure.
And that question is very timely because it's something that I'm trying to exercise myself by talking about sharing gratitudes and having appreciation when I wake up. And also we're trying to implement it with our children at night before we go to bed. It's like, what are your highs, you know, and lows? But to recognize that and just being fully appreciative of what we have going on here.
Yeah. Because it's a very humbling lifestyle, mm-hmm, you know, yeah, mud and muck and poo of all sorts of different species. And so, you know, it can be tough compared to you working behind a computer and laptop at an office.
Mm-hmm. No, your home is in the middle of the chaos.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's something about working alongside your kids too. Like, so I've been working on fence all day today with our 8-year-old, and we've been here, what, 12 years now? Mm-hmm. And we just this, like, past couple of weeks ago, bought a side-by-side. And up until that point, everything we've always done, like, manually. Like, walking back in the woods and building fence and stuff. And today he's like, why didn't we get this a long time ago?
Builds character.
He's like, I don't understand. This helps so much. I'm like,
well, have it, he would have been back there and I would have said, okay, you got 10 minutes to get up here. He'd be like, I'm not going to make it.
Yeah. But yeah, it was so funny today. Like, kind of what you guys are saying, yeah, you know, it's just like, yeah, you're right, dude. This is a lifesaver, but yeah.
I want to add also is that it's difficult. We're not fully exited the matrix or anything like that, but to find that balance of being able to homestead, but also, yeah, have the other things to look forward to and going out and having the children, like if we go to Gatlinburg or something like that every now and then, we're still striking a balance. And I have to mention that because we're seeing that what Joel Salatin says, a tsunami of homesteaders coming from the cities. They're not just going to snap their fingers overnight and become, you know, hardcore homesteaders. And what does that mean, right? You have to kind of find that balance, strike that balance so that we can keep the family unit together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know. And I mean, we have been at this a long time, and even still, you know, the matrix may be real, but we can step our toes in and enjoy a few things here and there. And yeah, it's sometimes you get more sucked in and sometimes you pull yourself back out. I think for us, 2020 was just like a reaffirmation of what the choices that we've made. And everything stopped, you know, we stopped all our dance lessons. We stopped all our everything, you know, and so we were home all the time. And I don't think that we've gotten back to most of that. We're still like in this, like, oh no, let's just stay home. Let's just do, we used to travel a lot more and all of that, which is great. But, you know, it is kind of, it was like a, okay, you did have to snap for a minute. And now we're kind of like finally easing back into, okay, well, we'll let some of that back in and in a more comforting way, I think. We got a big letdown all of a sudden. Hurt our feelings. But I don't think it's about, it's interesting because I said, you know, being cynical is one thing, but just knowing where your faith really lies is probably the most important thing. And it's not in the things of this world, I think, probably for you guys as much as it isn't for us. So, well, I hope this is the beginning of a beautiful relationship. I'm excited to point people towards, you guys have a podcast too. You have a website, the name of which, if you'll share for our listeners to connect with you.
Yeah. So our website is sprinklewithsoil.com, and it's the same for Instagram and YouTube. And our podcast is called
Call to Farms.
A-L-T.
Call to Farms.
Call to Farms.
Call to Farms. Oh, I love it. That's even better.
People answer the call to farms.
Yeah. I love it. Well, great. So people connect with these beautiful people. Who will continue to inspire you and encourage you. And hopefully we'll cross paths again real soon.
Thank you so much, Lacey and Drew.
Thank you so much. This was great.